The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, a very, very good morning to you. How are you doing?
Boker Tov, yeah, we're recovering from what's been a very, very busy week indeed. And in fact, President Rudi Rivlin has been in Auschwitz and he has been in Germany this week, obviously as part of the commemoration of the 75th anniversary of the release of the Auschwitz death camp and the release of the prisoners who were there. Interestingly, he addressed the Bundestag this week, the German parliament, in Hebrew. And I think that that's a real moment in our history when the president of Israel can address the German parliament in Hebrew. I think it was just a fascinating moment. It's only the second time that an Israeli president has addressed the Bundestag. The first time was President Shimon Peres about 10 years ago. And so, of course, as part of the commemoration of the freedom of the Auschwitz death camp 75 years apart, I think it's an interesting moment and one for us just to reflect on a little bit. By the way, President Rivlin, even though he is from the generation of people who was alive during the time of the Shoah, he was actually born in Jerusalem, interestingly enough.
Oh, that is interesting. I wasn't aware of that. Also fascinating for me earlier this week, I took a screenshot of it, was Donald Trump tweeting in Hebrew. I thought that was also unimaginable in the past ever. I was just thinking, can you ever imagine the President of the United States ever sending out a tweet or a message like that in Hebrew? I thought was incredible.
Times have certainly changed, and you know, we spoke about the emotions that the survivors of the Shoah must be feeling, particularly at that moment when all the world leaders descended upon Israel to come to that Fifth World Holocaust Forum, how they would be feeling as opposed to the extreme emotions that they had to go through during the times of the Shoah, and how times have changed for those people who've seen, you know, good times and bad times, to see, you know, the President of the United States tweeting in Hebrew, as you say, and the President of Israel addressing the German parliament in Hebrew. 75 years is certainly an absolute lifetime in terms of the changes that have taken place over that period of time.
Yeah, incredible. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. But Clive also said this is also the first time Putin has granted a pardon to a foreign citizen prisoner. But let's, before we talk about that, I just want to talk about the security issue in Israel across the West Bank and Gaza. That was following the call for a day of rage tomorrow. Seriously, they can't disagree with a peace proposal. We can't negotiate it. We've got to immediately go to a day of rage. Is there something actually to rage about? Is there something, anything that offensive in this proposed peace agreement?
Well, I think that there is extreme offense that's been taken because, you know, one could argue that the peace plan has really been developed in isolation, in a vacuum, away from the consultations with the Palestinian side. Of course,
well, was that,
you would then go on and say that that's of their own choice,
right,
because they were invited a number of times to participate. Mm-hmm. And for reasons of their own, they decided not to participate. They don't believe in the administration of President Trump. They are opposing, you know, whatever. They displayed their own objections to the process that the Trump administration entered into. Maybe the fact that there was seemed to have been strong Jewish influence in the form of Jared Kushner, in the form of Jason Greenblatt, in the form of David Friedman, all, of course, American Jews who were involved in formulating the peace plan. And so, therefore, there seemed to have been something of a lack of trust in the partiality or in the impartiality of the group that had been put forward to generate this peace plan. We often find that when Jews are involved, even though they have an interest to obviously try and promote the Jewish side, because they're representing a national government in this particular instance, they're often very careful to show their impartiality and to really go maybe what, you know, some people would consider to be even further than they need to go in order to show that they don't necessarily favor unreasonably the Jewish side. I'm not sure whether that's really the case here, but obviously the Palestinians lost trust in this process a long time ago, and in the U.S. administration, and they distanced themselves. And so as a result of that, they've now not been party to all the formulations and the announcement and everything else. And the way that the only real way that they can express it is via these days of rage. Of course, missile fire last night from Gaza. Fortunately, the missile landed in an open area. There were no injuries. There was no damage done. Apparently, two further missiles were fired, which didn't even cross over into Israel and landed somewhere within the Gaza Strip. A call for a day of rage along the Gaza border tomorrow. And, of course, lots and lots of demonstrations across the West Bank and indications of real anger about what has been proposed. Mahmoud Abbas coming out saying there will be no negotiations over Jerusalem. And so effectively what he's saying is that this idea of allocating a piece of Jerusalem to be a capital of a future Palestinian state is not acceptable to him. What they want is the whole of Jerusalem, or at least more of Jerusalem than what has been allocated. So that's obviously not going to fly. And so effectively we're in a standoff situation. Jared Kushner was very cautious to say that he feels the Israeli government is moving a little too quickly now to implement sovereignty over those areas where the Trump plan calls for Israeli sovereignty. He thinks that that should really only be undertaken after the election. After the election, we're not assured of having a government even. So, you know, it's an interesting concept. I don't know what the election will bring out. But obviously he's a little concerned that talking about it already on Sunday at the cabinet meeting is a little too soon after the ink has dried on the Trump plan. So all in all, we've got quite a lot of confusion around what all of this really means. And we know that Defense Minister Naftali Bennett has toured around the West Bank, and he has consulted with Chief of General Staff Aviv Kochavi, and they've decided that increased security is absolutely required. And if that's the case, then one would imagine that they have good reason to believe that there's going to be a real uptick in attacks that might be carried out, or violence that might be perpetrated. So obviously we are watching things very, very carefully to see what the next few days and the next few weeks will bring us.
Yeah, certainly it is a bit worrying. And let's just talk about Naama Issachar, an amazing it's such a relief for me. I generally, although I sometimes get quite caught up in stories, I found this story to be really heartbreaking, because I kept thinking about the well-being of this child, effectively, in a Russian prison. And the fact that she has been pardoned is just so massive, I think.
It is. It's historic. I mean, she's not really a child, because she's actually 26 years old, even though her pictures make her look, I think, a lot younger than she really is. Maybe they're slightly older pictures, but 26 years old. And of course, the first time, as that listener wrote in to say that a foreigner has been pardoned by Russian President Vladimir Putin, he did say to Naama's mother that he felt that she came from a good family and that, you know, she will be all right. Those were his words when they met last week. And of course, he has now moved to pardon her. Here's the interesting piece. Prime Minister Netanyahu has been in Washington, as we know, for those meetings with President Trump and the announcement of the peace plan. He then announced that he would fly from Washington to Moscow to meet with Russian President Putin in order to update him regarding the events of the peace plan and what that means, and further discussions. I mean, we know that they've met only less than a week ago while President Putin was in Israel. So this is just a very, very quick meeting after the previous meeting. It seems very soon. Of course, the agenda item here is to pick Naama up, bring her home on the prime ministerial plane. And of course, you know, part of the election campaign would be presenting pictures of Prime Minister Netanyahu bringing Naama and her mother back to Moscow. I mean, that's obvious what's going on. You know, none of us are foolish enough not to see through that one. But that seems to be what's going to be happening today. I think that the Prime Minister will be in Moscow, probably have a short meeting with President Putin, probably not to update him because he's probably well updated anyway, but just to thank him for releasing Naama. And of course, the main event will be putting Naama and her mother on the prime ministerial flight and bringing them home to Israel with a photo opportunity when they arrive at Ben Gurion Airport. That's what's going to happen. I'm pleased for Naama. I'm pleased for her family. I'm pleased for Israel that we don't have to consider this. The main question continues to rage as to what the prices that Israel has to pay. The government has said quite specifically that there was no price to pay. The Israeli public think that this means that Putin has Israel and Prime Minister Netanyahu effectively at his disposal in the event that he might require anything in return. There have been rumors about the fact that the government has agreed to give up a piece of land in Jerusalem's old city in order to compensate the Russian government, a piece of land that's called Alexander Court in the Christian quarter of the old city, which has been disputed by the Russians and by the Orthodox Church. And it seems as if, though, there might be some truth to the fact that the Israeli government has effectively granted some level of sovereignty to the Russian government over this piece of land, I suppose similar to what the French government have claimed over the Church of St. Anne that we discussed last week. So some anger about that. Anyway, the upshot of the whole story is it seems that Naamah will be home, if not later today, then tomorrow, together with the Prime Minister and his wife and their entourage coming back from Washington.
Of course, Sarah's going with for the trip. Yossi wants to know, to what degree do you think Bibi and Putin's warm relations have to do with her release?
Well, I think they certainly play a role. And I don't really know whether Bibi and Putin really have the warm relations that Prime Minister Netanyahu likes to present to us. I think that, you know, we've discussed this before, this kind of love-hate relationship that exists between Russia and Israel. On some, in some cases, there's good cooperation. And just on other, at other times, the cooperation seems to almost not exist at all. When we still consider the fact that the Russian troops are based in that area of southern Syria and are supporting the Syrian government and some of those renegade groups who are really operating against Israel's best interests along the northern border with Syria, then, you know, that's one thing. When we see how Syria operates in the international community, sometimes in the United Nations and at the UN Security Council, voting against Israel and really not promoting Israel's interests, when it doesn't seem to be able to be costing Russia anything in particular to support Israel's cause. We also know that there's a little bit of a tension between Russia and Israel on the issue of natural gas, where Russia, of course, is supplying a lot of natural gas to Europe, and Israel is now coming up as a potential competitor. So I think there are a lot of reasons why Russia and Israel don't agree. And by the way, we haven't even spoken about Russia's support of Iran and supplying of arms and ammunition and things like that to Iran, and therefore indirectly to Hezbollah. All of those are major issues between Russia and Israel. And yet, you know, at least on the face of it, the two leaders seem to have a reasonable relationship. And I'm sure that that would have contributed something towards Naamah's release.
Jenny wants to know, and just to seek some clarity on this, going back to the Palestinian Day of Rage around the peace plan, Jenny says the Palestinians, I think, have, from what I understand, have been holding a day of rage every single Friday for the last 18 months. Please, can you just confirm that with Anthony?
Well, there have been protests along the Gaza border for an extended period of time. At one stage, there were very vocal, and there was a lot of activity and many people turning up every week, and even a lot of incidents, people unfortunately being injured and shot, you know, a lot of security along that Gaza border. In recent months, it's kind of waned a little bit. Less people, I think maybe the weather has contributed to it. Hamas at one point called it back and said they don't want to continue these Friday protests anymore. But certainly tomorrow, there will be a lot more energy and probably more people and probably more incidents along that Gaza border in response to the events of this week. So what Jenny says is partially correct. There have been ongoing protests along that Gaza border, but they seem to have kind of got less as the time has developed, but certainly they'll be renewed and reinvigorated tomorrow.
So maybe a way of looking at it, especially for our Jewish listeners who will be familiar with the concept, is often if you have a shiur, if you have a lesson, a rabbi gives a talk, he might give a talk every Wednesday evening, but one week he might dedicate it to the memory of the late so-and-so and so-and-so. So maybe just this Friday's Day of Rage is dedicated to the peace plan. So it's happening every week, but this one has a very, very special dedication.
undoubtedly, and of course there have been a lot of calls for even the Palestinian Authority government, the president has called for people to rise up and to, you know, he's effectively taken the lid off the pot and said whatever people choose to do will be supported by the Palestinian Authority administration. Whereas up until now, they've really been quite specific in avoiding conflicts and clashes with the Israelis, and they've really had a lot of security cooperation with Israel, but apparently the lid is off now, and they're calling for people to rise up and to protest against this. That's the only real voice that they have, Howard. They have no real other way of expressing themselves. They have nobody to talk to at the moment within the international community. So this seems to be the only way that they can express their frustration at the events of this week. Not that it's necessarily going to help them take them anywhere, but at least, you know, this will just let the frustration out. And from the Palestinian Authority point of view, we'll be able to point the frustration from the Palestinian street towards the international community rather than for the Palestinian Authority administration to absorb it themselves.
Yeah, fascinating indeed. That's unfortunately where we do have to leave it. It is 8:01. Anthony Reich, thank you as always. Thank you for a great week of very important and up-to-date news and analysis. We'll catch you on Monday morning. Hope you have a great weekend and a Shabbat Shalom. Here is Zanati with your news.